This talk this evening is about mindfulness, and let me excuse myself for my voice. I live over in Campus Commons, where they completely overplanted with trees, and with this weather, you know, the trees and the plants keep blooming and then not blooming and blooming and not blooming, and so it's really played havoc with my hay fever and my voice. So this is a talk about mindfulness. It's entitled Remembering and Forgetting. And in the original definition of mindfulness, one of the elements is an element of remembering or to remember, which I think provokes the obvious question of what is it that we're forgetting and what is it that we're supposed to be remembering. So that's what I'd like to address this evening. And with some of the popular definitions of mindfulness, you're like moment to moment, non-judgmental awareness. And if that's all we have, if that's the definition of mindfulness, it seems to imply that mindfulness is being reduced to sensory awareness, what we see, what we feel, what we hear, what we touch. And then you hear the instruction, you know, when you're washing the dishes, just wash the dishes. When you're eating, just eat. When you're walking, just walking. And another popular definition that you see in the lay press is choiceless awareness, which is also a term of art, which seems to imply that it doesn't matter what we're paying attention to, as long as we're present for what's arising. And so there's a whole series of definitions that you hear of mindfulness, but when they are this short, they are partial in nature, and they're really taken out of the rich context and the network, the whole framework of instruction and teaching by the historical Buddha on what mindfulness is and then how it relates to the rest of the teachings, and then particularly its underlying psychology. So mindfulness is much more than a slogan or many of the things that you're seeing in the lay press now. So what I'd like to do is focus on mindfulness in the sense of mindful meditation, mindfulness in meditation, and address a number of issues of what is it that, what does to remember mean? And I think there's a number of different ways we can answer this. When you look at the handout, if we're talking about Buddhist meditation, it means a whole series of things. And so I'm going to select several to focus on. So the first one, and I think some of these definitions imply in the same way that some of the popular definitions imply that it doesn't matter what we're paying attention to, it also implies that mindfulness isn't purposeful in terms of being directive, that we're trying to accomplish a specific objective other than this large overarching goal of trying to mitigate or eliminate suffering in our lives. Okay. So the first question for me is about remembering is mindfulness purposeful? And if it is, what is the purpose? And I find it really helpful to go back and look at the trajectory of the Buddha's, the historical Buddha's training prior to his night of awakening. And he was part of a group of people who were practicing in a tradition which we now call a Shramana tradition. And they were separate and apart, usually in small groups, and engaged in relatively extreme aesthetic practices. And, you know, we've probably all seen either pictures or the statues of the Buddha where he looks emaciated, which had to do with certain practices of denial. And all of these practices, when you study them, had something to do with trying to extract yourself from the realities of daily life. That's number one. And then number two, trying to suppress or avoid or deny emotions and desires and aversions. So that all of these practices were designed to place the mind in an altered state of consciousness, and the theory was is that if you could do that, you would extract yourself from all of the things that were troubling you and that you would reach an awakened state of mind. The Buddha eventually, of course, walked away from this, and he opted instead for a very specific set of practices, which he subsequently outlined in great detail, with a specific purpose. And the purpose, in the sense that I'm talking about, is hinted at in the name of our group, Sacramento Insight Meditation. And the purpose of all of these many different techniques that the Buddha developed and in the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutra, which is referenced in the handout, the Buddha outlines 40 different objects of meditation. All of them are designed to generate a certain kind of understanding which leads to insight about the underlying nature of our experience and what kind of experiences point our mind into and towards suffering, and what type of experiences point our mind out of suffering and into a life of deep satisfaction. So that's really the starting place, because the liberation of the mind and the heart from suffering is based on a particular kind of understanding which is generated by insight. So the second question for me is how we pay attention important? Is how we pay attention important? And the distinction that I'm drawing here is paying attention through a conceptual or intellectual framework, or through direct experience of observation and feeling in the body and the mind. Okay. So the type of understanding and experience that the Buddha was talking about, and that these particular practices are designed to generate, are not conceptual, they're not thought-based, they're not intellectual, they're experiential. And I think one of the easier ways to distinguish this, and you've heard me talk about some of this before, but maybe it's more relevant in this context, is that there was a study done after World War II of 110 physicists that had been involved in all of the major projects here in the United States that produced the atomic bomb and a whole series of other things which had enormous benefit for our society and we're still all benefiting from. And a survey was done with all 110 of them, and the purpose of it was, this was done by a French study team, was to find out how they arrived at what seemed like really extraordinary insights that produced these breakthroughs. And so there were 40 questions and then an area where people could write an essay at the end if they wanted. And basically these questions were all designed to get to the question of how did the insights that they arrived at happen? You know, what did they do to make that happen? And in short, without going into a lot of detail, everyone reported that they engaged in an intense, prolonged period of intellectual, conceptual activity, and then either through exhaustion or just through choice, took a break from that, not thinking about the project at all. You know, people like they're getting on a bus, for example, or they're in the break room pouring a cup of coffee, and suddenly all of this intellectual activity would come together and they would have an insight, and then they would follow that inside up and you know, produce that into a mathematical formula. Because, you know, physics, as you know, is basically terribly advanced mathematics and is a mathematical representation of what we believe to be true about the natural world, you know. So that's basically the formula. Interestingly, they were asked if they had a method or a system to make this happen. And to a man and a woman, the 110 of them said, no, we don't, and we don't know how it happens either. It seems mysterious. All we know is that we put in this very, very intense period of practice, of intellectual activity, and then sometimes these insights appear and other times they don't. So we contrast that with the practices advocated by the historical Buddha that have, you know, a pretty good road test of 2,600 years. And they're a specific set of practices which are designed to put the mind in a particular place and then observe and experience what's happening in our body and our mind. And there is a general formula to make that happen, and the formula and all the practices are designed to generate insight, and they do. And of course the key is that you have to understand the practices and you have to follow them and you have to do it diligently. And if you don't do those three things, you may get some of the insights, but you don't get a lot of them, and you don't get a lot of the deep ones. You know, it's like any other system, right? There's a system, and it's designed to produce a result. If you follow the system, you have a very good chance of obtaining a certain result, and if you don't, you get something else, okay? So I think the important part about it is what happens just before the insights arise. And in one case, it's intellectual activity. It's conceptual activity. And in the other case, it is experiential. It is meditative in nature. So fundamentally, the what of what we're doing between cognitive insight and this form of insight are two significantly different activities. And so when we're in meditation, our effort is not to conceptually define things, intellectually figure them out, work with them in any way, intellectually or conceptually. After the fact, we certainly do. And we have insights, and we have to put those insights into words and concepts to understand them. And many of the insights, the deep insights that we have in meditation practice, we can't put them into words. And we can't put them into concepts, or we can't put them into words or concepts for a long time after we experience them. And, you know, I see some people shaking their head. Yes. And, I mean, I know that I've had retreat experiences that around the Nietzsche and not around impermanence and the absence of self, which at the time were, really quite profound. And it took me years, really, 2, 3, 4 years, to fully absorb what that experience was and to try to put it into some kind of language that I could express to someone else without sounding questionable. But you know, that's, you know, the death, you know, the mystic, right? You know, like Rumi and all these different mystic poets, they go out beyond the bounds of language and concept and intellect. That's where this practice takes us. That's what this kind of insight is. It is beyond concept and it is beyond intellect. So the mystic goes out and comes back, and what do they speak in? They speak in usually in poetry, right? They don't speak in prose most of the time. And so those of us who don't have that skill, you know, frequently we come back from some of these experiences and it's disorienting, it's confusing. And it takes a while, sometimes years, to put it into a framework that we can completely understand, because the deep insights are actually outside of our normal framework of reference. They are actually trying to undermine our normal frame of reference and our normal way of understanding ourselves and the world around us. It's a completely different paradigm. And so this is the reason that you'll frequently hear that the content of thought is not important in meditation practice. And you'll hear all the, you know, everyone who teaches talks about that, and this is the reason why. Because insight is not about thought. We use thought later, but the actual process of having experiential insight and understanding it initially is not thought-based. So the next question is what we pay attention to important? So the first one was, is how we pay attention experientially or conceptually or intellectually important? Second one is what we pay attention to important? And I'm just going to focus on one thing here. And so I think the fascinating thing about the meditation process is that we can pay attention to the normal stuff of our life. You know, we sit and close our eyes and what thoughts come up, sensations come up, emotions come up, the stuff that we're experiencing all day long. And so by doing a particular set of practices and paying attention in a particular way, we can pay attention to what's happening all the time and suddenly have significant insights about our life and about the underlying nature, what is just below the way we normally perceive ourselves and the world, and the way we normally understand it. So, I mean, I've always found it just like an extraordinary thing. Like, I mean, how is that possible that we can, one minute we're paying attention and the next minute we're paying attention, and suddenly we're having a completely different understanding? You know, what is that? Okay. And so in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, in the handout, there is a refrain that takes place over and over again. And I forget, I should have checked before I gave this talk. I don't know if it's 16 times or 26 times or 106 times. It's a lot. Okay. And it's right after each of the descriptions of the objects of meditation. Okay. And basically what the Buddha says is that in each one of these things that we should pay attention to, there are three things, the what of which we are looking for. Okay? Whether it's our breath, a sensation in our body, an emotion, a feeling, an attitude, a belief. And three questions are, what conditions cause that to arise? You know, like I'm sitting here one moment and I'm not thinking a disturbing thought, and the next moment I am thinking a disturbing thought. Or I'm sitting here and I feel equanimous, I feel very calm, and the next moment I'm suddenly not feeling that at all. I'm feeling some anger or some resentment or some lust. So what conditions cause whatever the experience is, and it applies to all experiences, no exception to the rule, what causes that to arise? What conditions? Okay. Everything arises from conditions. So second question is, what causes whatever that is, thought, an emotion, a mind state, to be sustained? You know, so it could be, it could stay the same, or it could increase in intensity. But what causes that in the middle of the life of a thought or an emotion to stay there. And then the third question is what causes it to dissipate and disappear? Those are the three things. So, you know, I think people are tempted when they read suttas, because it was an oral tradition and there's so much repetition, to think, well, the reason that that's being repeated there is just because it was an oral tradition, so people would memorize it or wouldn't forget it. And the common wisdom among scholars is that that is not the case with these three questions, that this was intentional and that it is fundamental to the meditation process, so that when we start to watch with those what's in mind, those three questions about whatever arises, you know, we start to see that everything is constantly changing, that it's just happening all the time and there's no exceptions to that rule. And because it's incessantly changing, that nothing stays around for very long. Now, our mind may relate to it as if it's going to stay around for a long time, or be fearful that it's going to stay around for a long time, or project out that it's staying around for a long time, or misperceive that it's been around for a long time and hasn't changed at all. But when we really look carefully, we see that nothing stays around for very long, and nothing certainly is permanent. And particularly, you know, our sense of an independent self. Not that we don't have, you know, an ego or a sense of self, but the notion that somehow there is an independent, unchanging, permanent self, once we start observing this way, just doesn't stand up to experience. You know, it's not philosophy. It's just like, just keep watching. And maybe you have to watch for a long time. And so what is, I think, really important to understand is that this way of practicing, this fundamental aspect of practicing, we simply can't do it if simultaneously we are trying to manage or control or suppress whatever is there. So if we're aversive to certain memories, to certain thoughts, to certain emotions, to certain reflections, and when they come up, rather than unconditionally open to them and explore these three questions experientially, if instead what we do is we try to apply something to make it go away or to end early or to suppress it, these two things are completely inconsistent. We can't deeply experientially explore the conditions that's causing something to remain present if what we're trying to do is make it go away. And so this is, I think, a profound question, issue, and my experience both working in my own practice, observing my own bad habits, and in working with students, is that it is quite easy to slide into trying to make something that we find unpleasant go away so we feel comfortable while we're sitting. And I would encourage you to look at that and see if that is an element, some element of your practice, or a particular part, your particular reaction to something. So part of this, what we pay attention to, I'd like to use a couple of, I think, are obvious illustrations, but in the service of forgetting and remembering, maybe they aren't so obvious. Okay, so the first one is what we're all familiar with, and this is, you know, basically emotional reactivity. And this process of dependent origination, which, I mean, we talk about all the time, that explains how we become reactive, how we attach to something, and how we identify. And, I mean, we all have to understand that and know that to have a sound meditation practice. So that's probably the first and most obvious. The second one, and this becomes a little more subtle in terms of what we're looking for and the conditions that cause something to arise, because we so deeply identify with them. And the way I'm framing this is emotional frameworks, principle, attitudes, or beliefs. And I think traditionally all of those would fall under the topic of view. But emotional frameworks, principle, attitudes, or beliefs. And the way these express themselves is something that I'm sure is really familiar to all of us, but in the moment of meditation, we're so deeply identified with it, I wonder how often we actually see that it's the condition leading to what we're dealing with. So I just wrote some down here. So I think it's unreasonable for someone to ask questions about certain topics, to ask me certain questions. You know, and those are quite like, well, I'm offended when somebody asks me something like that. People just shouldn't invade my privacy or whatever it may be. Okay. Well, there's some framework back there about, well, why is it inappropriate? And, well, what is that? Because those are the conditions that are generating the response. I read a book recently, and there's a series of chapters on a group called the Woodbridge Associates. And this is an investment fund back in New York. And they're spectacular. And they've been spectacular for years. And they have the most consistent record that exceeds anyone in the country, and have for years and years and years. You go to their website, look at their website, it's you know, you almost wonder whether or not it could be true. Because they are committed to kind of a radical form of truthfulness. And they have this group process of people respectfully challenging each other and challenging the premises that the business is based on. And they actually have like a boot camp that they put people through to train them in this process. It's really an extraordinary thing. And so they're interviewing the founder of this operation, and the author, who is a best-selling author, and you can see has a little bit of ego going. And so there's a chapter about the moment of truth, and the moment of truth is he's going to interview the founder. You know, so you can just hear from that, like, wow, you know, this guy's in trouble. I'm going to ask him questions. So at some point he puts this like really direct question to him, and kind of apologizes for asking the question. And his response is, "It doesn't matter. I'm beyond being offended." And he, you know, when you read about the guy, it's beyond a throwaway line or, you know, some tactic. It's like they've developed this method of being incredibly transparent and open. And they want to be challenged, and he wants to be challenged. You know, and you read in this book these sessions that he has, where he just kind of like opens himself to the whole company, and just allows people to go at it on him. You know, and so it's a value to legitimately criticize leadership. So most of the time we're not like really really clear about those kinds of principles. So this idea, well, you know, people shouldn't ask me those kinds of questions. Well, something's driving all of that. Okay, so when we really start getting quiet, we start seeing the things that are driving us. So another one, it's my opinion that you can't trust groups to make good decisions on certain topics. you know, like I just don't trust groups. I'm not saying I don't, I'm just saying, you know, like, I'm sure you talk with people who have fear of groups making decisions and controls over their lives. So what is the backdrop to that? What are the conditions, the attitudes, the beliefs, the fears that are driving that? The simple one that probably all of us are familiar with, that we're fearful of expressing emotions, or we're fearful of conflict, maybe we're fearful of intimacy. And that's really not the issue. You know, it's like, well, why? What are the conditions behind the fear that are causing the fear to arrive? Okay. I'm the kind of person that is, and then, you know, you can fill it in. I'm shy, I'm gregarious, I'm really competent, I'm impaired, I'm attractive, I'm unattractive, I have trouble being genuine, I'm really genuine. And then those beliefs about ourselves come from someplace, and you know, as you learn, as you grow older, frequently they're wrong. So there's something that's initially generating that, and then those are generating things. So you start to see that there's all this layering of conditions. And then the last one that I have here that I think really gets down to this kind of like core thing for many, many people, whether they're aware of it or not, but eventually bump into it, and that is that the world is not a safe place. You know, at some level, in some way, the world is not a safe place, and I have to protect myself. So that would be, first of all, there's dependent origination, reactivity. The second one are kind of emotional frameworks, principles, attitudes, and beliefs. And the third one, and this is in a way, I don't know, sometimes I think this is more subtle than the emotional stuff, maybe not, but I've framed it as conceptual or intellectual frameworks, principle, attitudes, or beliefs. Okay? Conceptual or intellectual frameworks, principle, attitudes, or beliefs. So what does that mean? Every architect, every accountant, every lawyer, every doctor, every psychologist, every artist, every fireman, every bureaucrat, and all of us in some way have, and so this could be formal as a profession or not so formal. You know, it could be a family of origin thing or experience, but all of us have been trained in a series of beliefs and principles that influence and shape and color how we see things and hear things and how we evaluate things and how we make decisions. So, you know, I'm sure that all of us have had the experience, or maybe all of us have had the experience of being around the teacher who can't stop teaching. You know, or the lawyer who can't stop cross-examining. Or the a therapist who, you know, you can just tell they're diagnosing you. I had this very, very good friend who was just an unbelievably skilled therapist, but he just could not help himself, you know. And so, like everybody we talk about, you know, we go in and have these meetings with government people, and we'd come out, and I'd say, "What do you think?" And the first thing he would do is give me a diagnosis for every person that was on the other side, you know, negotiating. So, I mean, you know, I could go on, but, you know, the issue is that the person who is doing that don't know they're doing it, right? And this can be in very gross forms and then in very, very subtle forms, because the dynamic both with the emotional frameworks and conceptual frameworks is that they become invisible. They become such a deep part of us that we don't even know that they're influencing the way we see and hear and how we make decisions. And it is usually, you know, only after years of practice, you know, and deep practice that we begin to see those things. And I'm not going to go into details, but I actually had this experience the other day. And this is a feature of my life, both my professional life and my individual life, in terms of something that I, something that I am engaged in with other people frequently. Okay. And I've always thought that I had a bead on what was driving me and, you know, what caused me trouble and what have you. And the other day, I'm sitting in meditation, and just, you know, this is the way that really good insight, deep insight occurs. It's like neon, you know, just like, and the minute it arises, true insight, you know it to be true. There's just no question about it. It's not something like you have to think about later and like, well, gee, was that true in this circumstance? You don't have to do any of that. I mean, you know it to be true. And what came up was, boom, this insight, and what I thought had been driving my conduct for 69 years, I was wrong about. You know? This is fantastic. You know, I mean, and this practice is very humbling. You know, you have to be willing. You have to be willing to be humble. To accept these insights rather than go, oh, well, that can't be it. You know, that must be wrong. It must be what I ate just before I... but this really is the issue. The issue is that, you know, it's like the person who is, you know, just like, seems like such a brilliant person. And then they do something emotionally, you know, that is... that everybody else can see, except them, you know, and say, well, how is it that such a brilliant person on this particular thing can be so obtuse or stupid or unaware or whatever it may be? And it's this phenomenon. I mean, they are so identified with this, and it is such a deep part of either a personality structure or a framework of belief about the world that they don't even know that it's there. And it's influencing them, you know, every minute of the day. So there's all of this is in layers, okay? You know, dependent origination or reactivity. You just keep seeing that there's deeper and deeper levels of understanding it. You know, these emotional substructures, these intellectual substructures, the same thing. So I guess one way you could react to that is be a little depressed. That but they are so deep. But I think it's I'm absolutely convinced that one of the beauties and the reliabilities of this practice is that this meditation process will not reveal anything to you that you are not capable of handling. So that, like, the insight that I'm talking about that I had the day before yesterday, had I had that insight 10 years ago, I think it would have been pretty devastating for me. I think I probably would have wanted to deny it. Or if I didn't deny it, I think it would have felt disabling. It would undermine my ability to operate in the world. But now it's just the reverse. You know, for me, it's almost kind of thrilling to actually see the truth of myself in the world, and not to have to feel like, well, it's me. You know, this is what impermanence and the absence of a permanent self in each and not are all about. Is the longer this practice goes on, the more you see that things are changing all the time. And that because the change is incessant, that they don't stick around for a long time, and that nothing is permanent. So when this comes up and you see it, well, it's been around for quite a while, you know. And the reason it's been around for quite a while is why? Because of ignorance. Right? The absence of seeing that is, in Buddhist practice, what we call ignorance. And so when that veil is parted and you see that, you suddenly have, for the first time in your life, choice about that particular thing. It's just extraordinarily thrilling, you know? And you've heard me say this before, but it is that function where then your practice and your life become your own inspiration. Because you realize that whoever it is that we ourselves are, by doing this process, will in fact be revealed to us. And that we can have choices about very, very deep things that before that moment we believed were permanent parts of whoever we think we are. And it turns out they're not. That's pretty thrilling, you know. So, okay, so where might you go to look at this some more? On the back of the little salmon sheet here, I've got a link to the Satipatthana Sutra, and then there is another version which is quite similar, but it is coming in at a little different trajectory, called the Maha Satipatthana Sutra, Maha meaning great, and that is a slightly different approach to the Four Foundations. So there's a site on that, and then kind of one of my go-to books, even though it was written back in 1976, and some of the language is a little outdated, but the discussion of issues to this day continues to be highly relevant, and that's Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And then, of course, he's written, you know, this tome in the last couple of years, which is based on, I don't know, something like 86 or 87 Dharma talks on retreat on mindfulness. And the book is called Mindfulness. And there's, at least I think, there's probably not anything more comprehensive or better for a Western audience that's out right now than that book. I don't have it cited here, but, you know, that's a work. Okay, so we've got a few minutes for discussion, questions, comments, and still getting out by 9, which is a rarity for me, so I'm feeling pretty good about that.
I like your talk, but to be honest, a lot of it went over my head tonight.
Okay.
And I was hoping you could explain a little how what you spoke about connected to what's on the sheet. I don't see the connection too much.
Okay.
I understand you talked about the paragraph down at the bottom of the table. What might we do with it?
Okay. So, and I'm referring to the chart now when I talk about this. The Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness answers the question, well, what are the dimensions for the fields of experience that we're directing our mind to during meditation or in daily life? And so this outlines the classical structure from that discourse by the Buddha. Okay, and then within each one, like the first one is the body as a vehicle for awakening. And it outlines, you know, it just references the various practices. You know, we're real familiar with breathing and bodily sensations. But then there's these bodily reflections, which, you know, we don't do too much. You know, these 32 reflections on the parts of the body and cemetery practices and what have you. So this is just kind of a reference point, which I personally find very helpful in, just sitting with this and looking at it as the map of where the Buddha was taking us in terms of the meditation process, the mindfulness process. So, That's it.
Just a minute, on fourth field, when you talked about nature of experience, if it's, it's one of those, this is the Dhamma, this last part of the four foundations, and I don't know what that would be making reference to, since it seems like all of this is experience. So what was he referring to when he, or what do you referring to when you use it, nature of experience, within this category?
Could you paraphrase her?
Okay. She, under the fourth foundation, after the initial box, you know, the initial box says experiential frameworks to understand. It says the nature of struggle and the path of awakening. That's what you're referring to, yeah?
The nature of struggle. I'm not seeing that.
Okay, so.
The nature of experience you were asking about?
Yeah, I was just looking at the nature of experience. In the fourth
oh,
field.
Okay. The nature of experience. All right. So.
Because I know the six sense bases, I know the five aggregates and the five.
Okay, I'm going to answer your question. Okay. So the nature of experience, it says the six sense bases, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we normally, you know, a conventional perspective on how we're experiencing the world is that, well, you and I are engaging each other now and talking to each other, and there's these two consciousnesses engaging each other, right? Okay. What the fundamental underpinning, so like when we're answering these three questions, what causes something to arise to be sustained and then dissipate? Okay. The starting place is, well, what is the nature of experience itself? And the Buddha's deconstructional answer to that is that we have sense doors, okay, so like an ear, okay, and assuming that your ear isn't impaired, okay, there's a bell, nothing's happening yet, right? Okay, so I hit the bell, sound wave travels from here, touches my ear, and ear consciousness arises. So with each one of the sense doors, there is a sense door, there is an object, and then there is something that happens that links the two, and that is how consciousness arises. So this is the fundamental nature of how our experience arises, and then the next thing that happens is that for every experience, we have a response. This isn't a choice. We have a response of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral to it. Okay? And then from there, if we're aware of that, or if we're not aware of it, it may escalate, you know, depending on our ability to be aware and do something about it. Escalates up into desire, aversion, to attachment, and then to identification, and then it's a sense of self, and we're gone. So that is the fundamental nature of experience. Now, most of us, you know, are applying this as, well, you and I are talking and you say something and I don't like it, and so there's aversion and then attachment to my view and identification and I'm lost. What the Buddha would say is, you know, it's kind of like you're way behind the ball, because it started at the contact with the sense door, and pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, okay? So we're trying to get further and further back on that chain. And if we can, that objectifies it, okay? If I'm reacting to you, or I don't think you should ask me that kind of question, you know, I'm way down the chain, right? But if I can actually watch for pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, you know, I think, I guess this was in the beginning class, one of us were talking about it this evening, and I had said that for an entire year, at the beginning of my practice, the only practice I had was pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's all I did. That's it for the entire year. And it was extraordinary. You know, the first thing I learned was I thought that I was fairly knowledgeable about my emotional life. And I realized that I wasn't. I had all kinds of ideas about it. But actually feeling what was happening is that I honestly really didn't know what I was feeling. And so that shaped my whole practice, that practice of just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, over and over and over and over and over again, sitting all day long, daily life practice, okay? Because I so strongly believe in these teachings, you know. So that's a long answer to your question. Okay, so I'd like to thank everybody very much for coming tonight. I think this is really a gift. I'd like to thank you for bringing your parakeet. My mother raised canaries and parakeets, so every time I'm around a parakeet, I feel great, you know. So, may our practices individually and as a group in some very real way contribute to the reduction of suffering in life and to opening doors for people to experience some true satisfaction. So thank you.